A possible recount in Ohio and Kansas, a reunion of the class of 74, and a retrenchment of voting rights? All will be revealed on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. We still don't know who won in Ohio's 12th district, but should the close margin give Republicans cause for worry in November?
The Republican majority was at risk before this race. It's at risk after this race. Democrats don't need to win this type of district.
We do know who won the midterm elections in 1974, and a new book chronicles how the class of Watergate babies sought to change the ways and means of Washington.
Overwhelmingly, Democrats and Republicans told me they ran to end the war in Vietnam.
And 53 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, we'll consider the law's impact and the threats it faces today.
Arguments like voter ID, which I say has a simplistic appeal, but it's aimed at pushing people out of the political process. That's backwards.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 240 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Well, guess what? It wasn't about adoption after all. That infamous meeting at Trump Tower in June of 2016 that included Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, and Jared Kushner, among others, and a Russian female lawyer with ties to the Kremlin was actually about, sit down, this could shock you, getting dirt on Hillary Clinton. Who knew? Until now, the Trump tale had long been, oh no, it was just about adoption in Russia. Now, following a presidential tweet from last week, the meeting was what everybody thought it was, designed to get dirt on Hillary. As Trump tweeted, it's totally legal, and it's done all the time in politics. Well, he's right, it is done all the time in politics, but it's illegal to get campaign help from a foreign government or a foreign entity, and the media have pointed that out. And that was too much for an apoplectic Sean Hannity on Fox.
We've been telling you now how the media lies on a daily basis about all things Trump. And by the way, again, yes, your mainstream corrupt, destroy Trump media caught red-handed, this time pushing phony moral outrage, again caught lying to you, the American people. Now, this weekend, they actually repackaged an old story, really old, over a year old, about Donald Trump Jr.'s 2016 meeting with a Russian lawyer in Trump Tower. They literally this weekend tried to pass it off as a major news scandal. And by the way, in moments, we're going to prove it to you. We'll call out the fake crisis peddlers that are the so-called news media in this country. And by the way, on the left, they all seemingly want this president to fail. That's sad at all costs because they want Democrats back in power.
You know, after hearing him, yes, sad is the word I would use as well. I'm not sure what the word is regarding the Paul Manafort trial. According to his former top aide, Rick Gates, crimes were committed under Manafort's direction and that millions of dollars were hidden away in secret foreign bank accounts. The trial continues to be an open display of confession and betrayal. Speaking of betrayal, Congressman Chris Collins, an upstate New York Republican and the first member of Congress to endorse Donald Trump for president, was arrested Wednesday morning on insider trading charges. It's a story so riveting that it almost made us ignore this week's primary results. Almost. We'll talk about that special Ohio congressional election later in the show. Much of what we saw in Tuesday's primaries were completely predictable, but there were some surprises. Voters in Missouri overwhelmingly rejected the state's right-to-work law that was passed by the legislature last year. It was a rare victory for the labor movement. Kathy McMorris Rogers, who is chair of the House GOP conference, is the fourth highest Republican in the House, barely received more votes than her Democratic opponent in Washington State's 5th congressional district, and she suddenly looks very vulnerable for November. Still, the big news is the neck-and-neck Republican gubernatorial primary contest in Kansas. Jeff Collier is the incumbent, having succeeded to the post earlier this year when Sam Brownback resigned to join the Trump administration. But he was challenged by Kris Kobach, the Kansas Secretary of State, who has a national reputation for his crusade against vote fraud, real or imagined. Armed with an unexpected endorsement from Trump, Kobach held a fewer than 200-vote lead over Collier as of Wednesday afternoon. It is a true nail-biter. And it's one that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last unelected Republican governor to be toppled in a primary? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
They say that breaking up is hard to do. Now I know that it's true. Don't say that this is the end. Instead of breaking up, I wish that we were making up again.
It was an open congressional seat in the northern suburbs of Columbus, Ohio. The 12th District had not voted for a Democrat since 1980. Before that, 1936. But with the incumbent Republican congressman having quit months before, and President Trump's national numbers still weak, it became a race with national overtones. Millions of dollars were pouring in. Could Danny O'Connor, the Democrat, win and give his party hope for November? Would Troy Balderson, the Republican, hold on to the seat and give the GOP a sigh of relief? The fact is, as of right now, we don't have an answer. With 100% of the precincts reporting, Balderson has a lead of 1,754 votes out of more than 200,000 cast. Nathan Gonzalez is the editor and publisher of Inside Elections and knows a thing or two about congressional elections. Nathan, wow, what a night Tuesday night, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think it shouldn't have been a surprise going into election night. I actually think one of the biggest winners of the night was polling. You know, polling gets such a bad rap these days, but the polls showed that it was going to be a close contest, and it's a pretty darn close race as far as we can tell.
But is it good that a seat that has gone historically Republican to be dead even, you know, in this race? Does it say something about, perhaps, does it say something about November?
Well, whether Balderson won by a little or lost by a little, I think the overall trend is not good for Republicans. You know, to take a district that has been ancestrally Republican, as you pointed out, that most recently President Trump did very well, and to have it be a nail biter, I think is problematic, in part because it continues the trend of the special elections, except for Georgia 6. Which seems like it was 8 years ago that happened. It was only last June, where Democrats have consistently overperformed. And so one of the only ways that Republicans have been able to squeak out some of these narrower victories have been by pumping in a lot of outside money, because consistently the Democratic candidate has outraised the Republican candidate, so outside groups have to make up the difference. The challenge when you look ahead to November is that there are dozens of competitive races. Republicans have at least 65 plus vulnerable seats. They're not going to be able to spend $3, $4, $5 million in every race to try to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat. So that's why I think overall the trend is good for Democrats, because I don't think the way that Republicans have pulled these out is not scalable across the many elections in November.
Plus the fact, when you think of the district that that Conor Lamb won in Southwest Pennsylvania and the one in Ohio 12, those were big Republican seats. There are a lot of districts that the Republicans narrowly won in 2016. And those are the ones, you know, I mean, if the landslide Republican districts became close, what about all those districts that were close in 2016?
That's exactly right. I mean, Republicans say, look, it's about wins and losses, and we won and they lost. And that's been repeated over and over, except for Pennsylvania 18. They don't talk about that. But the thing is that Democrats don't need to win Ohio 12 or that Pennsylvania seat that's been redrawn and renumbered, or Arizona 8, or any of these elections where they've come closer than expected. They don't have to win that Republican of a seat. They can focus on the Hillary Clinton districts. They can focus on districts that Donald Trump won more narrowly than Ohio 12 or the others, and they can get to the majority. They don't even have to. They don't have to win Ohio 12. Balderson can win a full term, and Democrats still be in the majority next year.
We talked about Balderson's lead, which is currently at 1,754 votes, but there are provisional ballots out there. I think there are twice as many provisional ballots out there that have yet to be counted.
Yeah, and that's the, I mean, there are enough, as far as I know, there are enough outstanding that could make up the difference. I think they would have to be very disproportional in favor of O'Connor. So we should leave ourselves open to the possibility. But, Democrats would like to have the seat. They'd like to be one seat closer to the majority. But I think they're fine with kind of continuing on and moving on with the other races that are happening around the country.
Well, I know we're not certainly calling the race yet, and neither is anybody else, but Troy Balderson seemed to call the race when he said this on Tuesday night.
I'm honored, very honored, for the opportunity to represent the voters of the 12th Congressional District and who they have bestowed on me. Tonight, I'm going to promise to you that I'm going to work relentlessly for this 12th Congressional District.
Not only does he have to work relentlessly, he's going to face, no matter what happens, in if there's a recount or whatever, or the counting of the provisional ballots, the two of them still run against each other in November.
Right. I mean, this special election is just for, the last remaining months of this Congress, but the two they're already going to face off. We already know that they're going to face off for the regular election for the 2-year term in November. So, I actually appreciated last night that most of the candidate speeches were very short. He kept it to the point and realized that they can take a break today maybe, but continue. They have to keep the campaign going, and that I think that cuts both ways. I mean, in a way, Republicans won't have the opportunity to pump in as much outside money to help him, to help Balderson if he needs it. But also, O'Connor won't have the benefit of being the only game in town. He won't be the only focus of Democratic energy. Democratic resources and donors are going to be spread across dozens of districts as well.
What role would you say did President Trump play? I mean, he gave a full-throated endorsement of Balderson. John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, who's not Trump's best friend, also weighed in with an endorsement. Do you think either one was significant?
Well, I think we probably are in agreement that campaigns and these races are complex organisms, and I think it's tough to isolate individual factors in a race. I mean, it is a culmination of hundreds, if not thousands, of factors that play into this. I did think it was pretty interesting that the president tried to take credit for the victory when the only reason why we're talking about this seat right now is because he is president of the United States. I mean, if Hillary Clinton was president, we certainly wouldn't be talking about it, this race, in this way. And if, I don't know, Marco Rubio were president, we wouldn't be talking about this way. President Trump is such a polarizing figure and an energizing figure for Democrats that's why we're here. And I think it's like for the president to take credit, I think it's like lighting a house on fire and then trying to take credit for bringing a bucket of water to try to put the thing out.
Another controversial name in that district was Nancy Pelosi. What role did she play in Ohio 12, and what role is she playing in some of these closer races around the country?
Well, Republicans definitely went to the Pelosi message to try to tie it to O'Connor. I think it was a part of the conversation. He stumbled, I would say, in a Chris Matthews interview where he was evasive, and Chris Matthews kept pushing him on it, and O'Connor didn't look good. He eventually came back around after the interview and said he wouldn't support Nancy Pelosi, and you know, maybe that made up the difference in the race. But still, I kind of come back to and it was sort of similar in Pennsylvania 18. Republicans went to the Pelosi message. Democrats said it didn't matter. It wasn't effective, but yet Connor Lamb had to go on television and address it head on. So it's, I guess there is still some impact for Republicans with the Pelosi message, but it's not enough to really blow these races open or really put a lot of distance or to definitively hinder a Democrat from winning. You know, they're taking those hits. They might go down a little, but they're still in the game.
We heard from Troy Balderson. Here's what Danny O'Connor said on Tuesday night.
Can you believe how close this is? We are in a tie ball game.
So, you know, Nathan, when do you think we'll have an answer?
Candidly, I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's going to take at least a few days because I believe ballots people had until Tuesday to return ballots. And so there's just a sheer U.S. Postal Service trying to collect those and count those. But I feel like the votes were the ones that were cast, either cast early or cast on Election Day, were counted pretty quickly. So I try to be optimistic that we'll get those before too long.
And in the scheme of things, if there's something to be said about Ohio 12 and November, what would it be?
Well, I always try to take the long view. I mean, the Democratic or the Republican majority was at risk before this race. It's at risk after this race. Where Democrats don't need to win this type of district, but I think it's indicative of a midterm election with a polarizing president. And, you know, Democrats have enough seats in play to win this. We're just not exactly sure what combination of seats they can actually get and if they can get over that 23-seat margin necessary.
Nathan Gonzalez is the editor and publisher of Inside Elections. Nathan, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll meet again. Don't know where. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
There are fewer than 100 days to go before the November 6th elections, and at this point, there is no telling what will happen. Will the good economy help the Republicans hold on to their majorities in the House and Senate? Is there enough anti-Trump sentiment to put the Democrats in charge of either chamber? Who knows? Any political junkie knows that the history of midterm wave elections is often filled with intrigue and surprises. Democrats capitalizing on anti-Bush feelings in 2006 to give them the House and the Senate. Republicans returning the favor in 2010 when they won back the House. And in 2014 taking the Senate along with it, capitalizing each time on anti-Obama sentiment. The midterms of 1974 were one of those wave elections. Going into the election, Democrats had about 50 more House seats than the GOP, but voters rebelling against the Republican Party over the Watergate scandal, a scandal that forced President Nixon out of office, well, the Democrats managed to pick up another 43 seats. All in all, there were 75 or 76 new Democratic members of Congress in the class of 74, but this was not just about the numbers. They were a group determined to battle not only the Republicans, but the old status quo of the Democratic establishment. They were going to change the way Congress worked, and they did, for better or worse. John Lawrence has written a wonderful new book about the class of 74. It's called, ready for this, The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. John is a professor at the University of California's Washington Center. Before that, he worked in the House for 38 years, the last eight as chief of staff to Nancy Pelosi, the once and perhaps future speaker. John, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Ken, thanks so much. I'm really honored to be here.
You know, we have seen gigantic new classes of House members in midterm elections before and since 1974, but there was something different about the class of 74. What was it?
I think a lot of what was unique about the class of 74 was the diversity of its membership, the fact that it came, so many of its members came from non-traditional political backgrounds. There, and in some ways, not unlike 2010, where you had this large infusion of Republican conservatives, although I think there are some very significant differences. About half of the class of 74 actually had political experience, even though some of the more senior members castigated them for never having licked envelopes or walked precincts. There were a lot of people who were mayors and state legislators, county officials, district attorneys. But there were also a lot of people who came out of the politics of the political movements of the time, the consumer movement, the anti-war movement, the student movement. And I think that's important for two reasons. Number one, it was they had less regard for the institutions of leadership, although they were not by any means disrespectful of the institution of government. As liberal Democrats, they needed government. And the other was that many of them won seats that they had no intention, they had no expectation that they were actually going to be able to hold on to. And so they were impatient. They wanted change to come quickly. And they were not willing to sit by as earlier freshman classes had been instructed to take a while, learn how the place works, defer to the chairman and to the leadership. They arrived, as George Miller of California, one of my former bosses, said, they came to take the Bastille. And what they found was a group of long frustrated reformers who were waiting for them to arrive so they had sufficient numbers to implement these reforms. When they walked into the Democratic caucus in 1974, in December, Bella Abzug, one of those earlier reformers, said, well, the reinforcements have arrived. And they had. They had arrived and they provided the votes to really change the way the House functioned.
I know you can't speak for all of them, and I know there was a deep dislike of the seniority system, but what do they want to accomplish?
When I talked to them, it was interesting that you asked that, because most people, if you read the counts that have been written thus far before the class of 74, almost all of them focus on their reform agenda. But actually, when you speak to these members, very, very few of them, people who mostly had studied government, like Tim Wirth or Phil Sharp, Andy McGuire, they knew about the institutional problems in the Congress that needed reform in order for their policies to be feasible. But most of them really didn't. Most of them said, I wasn't running to reform the Congress. I didn't know anything about how the Congress was organized. When I said, why did you run? Overwhelmingly, Democrats and Republicans told me they ran to end the war in Vietnam. That, they believed, was the crucial issue that was driving the divisions in the country and that was preventing the country from addressing other agenda items, whether that was education or civil rights or women's rights or environment or consumer protection, a whole litany, energy reform. These were all the issues that had backed up on the agenda because the country was so divided and so at each other's throats over Vietnam. So that's why they ran. And when they voted in April of 1975 to cut off funding that President Ford had requested, they considered that they had accomplished one of the most important things that they had gone to Washington to do, maybe even more important than reforming the seniority system and enhancing the role of more junior members.
You opened your book with a story that made me gasp. It was about Philadelphia's Bill Barrett, who had been in Congress for decades. Can you repeat that story and try to make it as clean as possible?
Well, yeah, this is a story that I heard from a couple of different sources, and you can appreciate, people who read the book will understand why I wanted to get multiple sources before I used it. But it was certainly the story that I knew was going to open the book. So Bill Barrett, who's been in the Congress since the 1940s, is sitting on the floor at the beginning of the 96th Congress. He is going through papers. He's waiting around for the session to begin, and there's virtually no one on the floor except for a bunch of pages who are wearing their very traditional blue suits and ties. And he calls over one of these young people who has this long head of hair and looks to be about 18 years old, which is how the pages were. And he said, here, take these papers to my office. And this young man says to him, go F yourself. Take them to your office yourself. And Barrett was just utterly stunned. Obviously, nobody had ever talked to him in that manner, let alone a 17 or 18-year-old page. And he called Don Anderson, the manager of the Democratic cloakroom, over. He said, this page just told me to go F myself. And Don Anderson looks at Barrett, and then he looks over at the young man, and he said, well, Mr. Barrett, this page is actually your new colleague, Tom Downey from New York. And Downey, of course, was only 25 years old, and as you probably remember, he didn't look anything close to 25 years old at that point. And I just thought that both in terms of the rudeness of the shock, but also just the clashing of these two cultures. And Barrett wasn't a particularly bad guy from the standpoint of policy, but it was just the generational, the fact that it was incomprehensible that this young, brash kid could actually be a member of Congress, that I thought was very emblematic of the kind of institutional shock that this election registered on the House of Representatives.
You know, when I think back to the class of 74, what I always remember reading was they were a bunch of liberals not willing to compromise or respect the traditions of the House. And you say in your book that that's not necessarily the case.
That's the popular notion. And I think that was driven to some extent by their impatience, which I've already addressed, is I think was more impatience with the pace. It wasn't disrespect to the institution. But there isn't a lot of evidence that they were unwilling to engage in the normal kinds of political back and forth. They compromised on energy. They compromised on labor. They compromised on spending issues. They were surprisingly, in some ways, conventional when it came down to voting for legislation. And I would also point out they were also among the most loyal to the party leadership, even though they were frustrated with the party leadership. These were not people who were sitting back in the manner of some of the more extreme members that we have today and just said, well, you know, that's not good enough for me. I'm not voting for it. By and large, the class of 74, and this was certainly borne out a couple of years later when there was a memo that I was given by President Carter's staff looking at their voting record, they were pretty loyal of voting in terms of the party. They were not willing to make the compromises that are inherent in the legislative process. And in fact, many of them, George Miller and Henry Waxman, Phil Sharp, Jim Oberstar, became some of the most talented and most respected and most pragmatic chairman and subcommittee chairman in the ensuing years in the Congress. So I think that's a bad rap they get. I think it conflates their impatience with their skill as legislators.
You had some famous names that came out of that class. You had George Miller and Henry Waxman from California. I think they both served for 40 years. They were known for their work on behalf of children, the environment, and health policy. And you also had a bunch who not only went on to the Senate, but also ran for president. You had, I think, I'm looking at the list, you had four of them who went for the Senate and all ran for president. Paul Simon, you had Tom Harkin, you had Paul Tsongas, you had Chris Dodd. And that's all from the same class of House members.
Well, you also had Larry Pressler, who ran for president. And it was interesting. I have a whole chapter in the book about the Republicans, because I think these Republicans who were elected in 74 also find themselves sort of trapped between their own leadership and not being terribly welcome in the Democratic reformers. So it's an interesting group. Yeah, it's interesting that the class produced a number of really, really well-respected and skilled legislators, as I mentioned earlier, people who went on to chair committees, people who really wrote landmark legislation, whether in Miller's case it was education legislation, children's legislation, in the case of Waxman, clean air, clean water, energy legislation. And then you had these people who went on to the Senate and who ran for president, but you had nobody who rose in the leadership in the Congress, in the House of Representatives, other than through this very seniority system that they had challenged. And I think that goes to the point that they didn't really oppose seniority per se. They opposed certain people who use the seniority system to gain and maintain power. But really in that era, my theory is that you sort of made your decision whether or not you were going to be a legislator or you were going to move into the leadership positions. And generally, it was the case that certainly with the class of 74, they were more of a policy-oriented, which goes along with the kind of activism that brought them to Congress in the first place. They were more of a policy activist group than they were a party activist group that was inclined towards leadership positions.
Well, you mentioned there were some Republicans. I know we've only talked about Democrats, because when you think of the class of 74, you think of all those Democrats. But there was Chuck Grassley. There was Henry Hyde. There was Jim Jeffords, right, who made a big headlines when he switched parties. And there was one of my all-time favorites, Millicent Fenwick.
Yes. And it was also a diverse group. There were people like Fenwick and Jeffords and Pressler who very much viewed themselves as reformers. And there were harder-edged conservatives like Grassley and Hyde who were more in the mainstream of the Republican Party. But this is a very important period, this mid to late 70s, when particularly outside Congress, you see this rise of a largely an evangelical, Christian-based, conservative, grassroots fundraising and organizing that begins to challenge the traditional Republican leadership and the traditional Republican notion that they are an inherent minority. And many of those activists find that they have as much problem with the Republican leadership, which believes it has to basically compromise with the inevitable Democratic majority, and as they do with the Democrats themselves. And there becomes a very bitter fight within the Republican Party that largely gets overlooked, I think, or more often gets placed later in the 1980s. During the Reagan years, where the conservatives rise and really take out many of the more moderate northeastern, midwestern Republican moderates and liberals. But really, the origins of that Republican conflict and the rise of that very conservative element of the party really belongs in the 1975-1976 period. Interestingly, though, when I talked with some of these folks about the changes in the party, even the moderates, even somebody like a Pressler says, you know, if I had stayed in the House, I probably would have ended up supporting Gingrich because there just was no other way for the Republican Party to differentiate itself and challenge the Democrats and find itself in the majority. So even though they expressed great disillusionment with the extremism to which the party had gone, even the more moderate Republicans said they probably would have ended up supporting that change as the only route to the Republican majority.
Let me end this by asking you, what's your report card for the class of 74? What would you say they accomplished and where did they fail?
Well, I think they accomplished a lot. I mean, I think that they certainly institutionally, they provided the crucial votes that were necessary to effectuate some of the institutional change that moved power into the broader caucus and that returned power from the seniority chosen chairman to the electorally chosen leadership.
And where did they fail?
Well, I don't know that they failed as a class particularly. I think they felt that they were disappointed, I think, that the unity that they had demonstrated when it came to issues of reforming the House were not translated into policy because they could not overcome vetoes. So in that sense, I think they felt legislatively that they were not as successful as they had hoped. And there were obviously some natural divisions that occurred around issues like abortion or school busing or these very divisive issues, which Republicans used some of the reforms effectively to force votes on, where the divisions within the class became evident.
John Lawrence is the author of The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. He's a professor at the University of California's Washington Center, and before that served as chief of staff to Nancy Pelosi. John, thanks for a great discussion.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
That night we fell in love beneath the stars above. That was a lovely summer night. Remember then.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, when Ron Dellums, who died earlier this month, first ran for Congress in California, he defeated a white liberal congressman in the Democratic primary. Who was the most recent African-American member of the House who came to Congress by ousting a white incumbent? I accepted two answers. In 2014, Texas Republican Will Hurd, who's black, unseated Democratic incumbent Pete Gallego, who is Hispanic. Hispanics, of course, are not a race, but an ethnicity. So because of the uncertainty that Hispanics can be of any race, I also accepted as an answer Alan West of Florida, another black Republican, who ousted white Democrat Ron Klein in 2010. And the randomly selected winner is Carol Larson of Fort Worth, Texas. You may have heard of her. She named Will Hurd as the answer. Carol wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttle button winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. Our last contest led off with a non-political button that said, I, with a picture of a salt shaker and a lime, tequila. I love tequila, I guess. Then a Wendell Willkie button from 1940 that said, we don't want Ma Perkins or Harry Bridges either, referring to Francis Perkins, who was FDR's Secretary of Labor, and Bridges, the head of the Longshoremen's Union, who was convicted for lying about his past membership in the Communist Party. Then finally, two presidential buttons, one for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968, and one for West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd in 1976. So, when you combine tequila and Ma and King and Byrd, well, you kind of get Tequila Mockingbird, or as Gregory Peck would pronounce it,
Tequila Mockingbird, winner of the Pulitzer Prize and just about every other award a book can win. And now, happily, To Kill a Mockingbird becomes a motion picture.
And the winner is Jin Peck of Phelps, New York. You remember her. She was a Scuttlebutton winner in March of 2012. Well, she's a winner once more. We'll have a new Scuttlebutton puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
It's another tequila sunrise. This old world still looks the same. Another frame.
It's time for This Week in Political History. It was a ghastly scene, and it was seen live by countless Americans on their television set. Angered by laws that curtail their right to vote and intimidation tactics from authorities that often resulted in violence, several hundred civil rights demonstrators decided to march in protest, peacefully, to the Alabama State Capitol in Montgomery in March of 1965. As they crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, they were attacked, often brutally, by Alabama State Police. Photographs of the injured appeared on the front pages of newspapers everywhere. The events of Bloody Sunday led to President Lyndon Johnson to address a joint session of Congress and a nationwide television audience 8 days later.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy. I urge every member of both parties, Americans of all religions and of all colors, from every section of this country, to join me in that cause.
Enough was enough, said the president.
At times, history and fate meet at a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama. There, long-suffering men and women peacefully protested the denial of their rights as Americans. And should we defeat every enemy, and should we double our wealth and conquer the stars and still be unequal to this issue, then we will have failed as a people and as a nation. For with a country as with a person, what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?
And he said there was only one course of action.
We cannot, we must not refused to protect the right of every American to vote in every election that he may desire to participate in. And we ought not, and we cannot, and we must not wait another 8 months before we get a bill. We have already waited 100 years and more, and the time for waiting is gone.
The Senate passed the bill in May by a 77-19 vote, and the House followed nearly a month and a half later by a vote of 333-85. It was 53 years ago this week, on August 6, 1965, when President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. Ted Shaw is a professor of law and the director of the Center for Civil Rights at the University of North Carolina School of Law at Chapel Hill. He has spent decades testifying on, fighting for, and lecturing on civil rights. Professor Shaw, thank you so much for being on The Political Junkie.
Oh, it's an honor to be with you, Ken.
Well, the impetus to pass the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was the violence in Selma, but that's hardly the starting point for this story. As I mentioned to you before we went on the air, I think I want to start with the 15th Amendment.
Well, certainly the 15th Amendment is a good place to start because it was the post-Civil War amendment that granted the right to vote, at least protected it against racial discrimination for black men. Of course, not for women, but for black men. And it took about 100 years, as President Johnson said, before that became significantly meaningful. But listening to those tapes you played, all I can do is say, wow. You know, it's quite a contrast in terms of where we are now.
Well, there's truth to that, but I'm sure, as Johnson said himself, it was a big contrast between 1965 and it was in 1865 or 1870. I mean, just because a constitutional amendment passed that guaranteed everyone the right to vote doesn't mean that blacks were afforded the same voting rights as whites, especially in the southern states, the former Confederacy.
Well, that's right. As we know, in the Reconstruction era, there were African-Americans elected to office throughout the South, but that didn't last very long. In the post-Reconstruction era, the right to vote was denied to black people once again, and it took, as President Johnson said, about 100 years before Congress acted again. Every major piece of civil rights legislation was a response in large part to violence. And so it was with Bloody Sunday and the Voting Rights Act.
We saw a bunch of state legislatures. They were putting up impediments to voting, demanding to see an ID, cutting back early voting, curtailing the hours voting booths in certain precincts were open. I mean, this seems like it was an effort for some time by some state legislatures to gut the Voting Rights Act.
Oh, no question about it. I live in North Carolina now, as you noted. I've only been here since 2014, so it's been 4 years. But for about 25 years, I worked at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and among the cases I litigated were voting rights cases. And again, it was necessary to go to court to enforce the Voting Rights Act because legislatures worked around the Voting Rights Act or negated it. And North Carolina has been ground zero in recent years with respect to a number of efforts to keep black people from voting. So you mentioned voter ID, but there are other ways in which the North Carolina legislature made it hard or difficult and sometimes impossible for some African Americans to vote.
It seems like every time I turn around, there's always a story in the paper about the North Carolina legislature being hauled into court to defend its actions regarding voting.
Oh, that's right. It's an ongoing struggle. This is a very conservative legislature here, although it's, I rush to add, this shouldn't be about partisanship. This is about a right that is really one of the most sacred of American rights, the right to vote. To participate as a citizen in democracy. The legislature and other legislatures, many of them, don't see it that way. They are trying to keep people from voting, and I think that's anti-American, and it certainly is against the spirit and the letter of the 15th Amendment and the Voting Rights Act.
You mentioned a few minutes ago about the Supreme Court, the Shelby decision. Tell us what that means. Tell me what that's about.
As we've talked about, part of the Voting Rights Act that required preclearance of changes in voting schemes, you know, whether we're talking about moving polling places or going from at-large to single-member districts, you know, other changes, that was never meant to be a permanent imposition among the authority of the states, but periodically had to be revisited by Congress to see if it was necessary. Those of us who did voting rights litigation and advocated for voting rights, we had to go back to Congress again in 2006 and extend Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And we did so. It was a very intense effort, but we revisited conditions in these jurisdictions that had a history of discrimination, and Congress reenacted Section 5. I should say that in some jurisdictions like Texas and in North Carolina, immediately the day that the decision came down, seven legislatures enacted a raft of provisions that made it more difficult to vote.
So basically, I mean, what I'm hearing you say is that the ink was barely dry on the Shelby decision before some legislatures started to act.
That's right. Voter ID, which, if I can take a moment and point to voter ID, the proponents of those measures, they say you have to show an identification card to do all kinds of things, to get on an airplane, to drive, et cetera. And that's true. The right to vote is not equivalent to those things. It's not a privilege. It should not be a privilege. It's a right. And when I say a right to vote, I mean a right to be free of discrimination in the exercise of the vote, as opposed to a positive right to vote guaranteed by the Constitution. So immediately, they enacted voter ID laws. They enacted provisions that made it more difficult, not less difficult, to vote. For example, in North Carolina, we had early voting days. We had provisions that allowed people to do mail-in ballots, all kinds of provisions that African-Americans took advantage of and others, but those that African-Americans disproportionately took advantage of, those were targeted. And a federal district court in this part of the country recently said they were targeted with almost surgical precision when it struck down some of the North Carolina legislature's actions. But that just sends it back to the legislature, and then they reenact something that will have the same effect.
So if I'm going back 53 years, tell me how you saw the Voting Rights Act, what it did, was it its effectiveness, did it make a difference, and tell me if you think the momentum is now headed in the opposite direction.
Well, the Voting Rights Act made a tremendous difference when it came to political participation in American democracy. And it allowed African Americans, for the first time, to effectively have the opportunity to elect representatives of choice and also to participate by being elected to political office. So the impact was huge. But it was not a permanent guarantee. We can't assume that history only moves in one direction. When I listened to the Johnson speech that you started out with, that's what I was thinking about. You know, history doesn't only move in one direction.
Tell me which direction it's moving in now.
I think we're going backwards. I know we're going backwards when it comes to political participation. You know, arguments like voter ID, which I say has a simplistic appeal, but it's aimed at pushing people out of the political process not encouraging participation, that's regressive. That's backwards.
I'm listening to this conversation, and I can't begin to know what's in your mind and what's in your heart, but I almost feel that when our conversation began, and you hear Lyndon Johnson talking about the hope of 1965, there was maybe hope in Ted Shaw as well. And now talking about 2018 and what's going on now, I wonder if that hope has left you or is leaving you.
Well, this is a very difficult time, as we all know. I refuse to give up hope, but it's not because there's no reason to despair. There's a lot of reason to be very cynical these days and to despair, but you know, that's unpalatable. You know, if we do that, we lay down and die. But if you were asking me, as I believe you are, whether I think this is a time in which I feel good about what's going on in our country, particularly with respect to political participation, the answer for me is no. And it's because, in part, not only of the policies of the executive branch right now, but it also is because of what this Supreme Court has done recently in cases like Shelby County, and what Congress has done by failing to take up these issues in a constructive way. So do I feel good about it? No. Do I think that we have a kind of leadership that President Johnson was demonstrating in the clips that you played? No, I'm so struck by the difference between what he said and what he did in 1965 and where we are today.
Ted Shaw is a professor of law and the director of the Center for Civil Rights at the University of North Carolina School of Law at Chapel Hill. Ted, it was wonderful and depressing having you on the program. Wonderful and depressing at the same time, but I really, really appreciate you being on the show.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to be with you. In spite of the reasons to be depressed, we can't give up.
It was 53 years ago this week, on August 6, 1965, when President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, which protected and guaranteed the right to vote for African Americans. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
Think of all the hate there is in Red China. Then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to say grace. And tell me over and over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
And tell me.